April 7th, 1927. You have been cordially invited to the premiere of a brand new film by acclaimed French director Abel Gance at the Palais Garnier. The place is budding with excitement. Do you know anything about this? What do you think of Gance? Jacques Hughes was good, but I didn't much care for La Rue. Are you joking? La Rue was fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you don't know it yet, but you are about to bear witness to one of the greatest achievements in film history, Napoleon. You're listening to Film Survey with J.G. Murphy. I am your host, J.G. Every week, we explore the history and themes of some of the greatest films in cinema history. But instead of randomly picking films week in and week out, we look at a certain theme and multiple films that are linked by that theme, sort of like a college course. Our first section is Vive la France, French filmmakers and the story of France. This week, we examine Abel Gance's 1927 epic, Napoleon. This show is part of the TMK Pictures family of podcasts. For more content, please visit our website, www.tmkpictures.com, and our YouTube channel. Just look for the Green Clover. Napoleon is sort of a holy grail in the film world. There are, to date, 30 different versions of the film, ranging in runtimes as long as 9 hours and 22 minutes, to as short as 1 hour and 51 minutes. It has only been exhibited 3 times in the United States, in 1929, 1980, and 2012. The version we will be focusing on today is the most current and most accurate version, Kevin Brownlow's 2004 edit, with a daunting runtime of 5 hours and 32 minutes. The Blu-ray that I own is not even available for sale in the United States. I had to buy the film from BFI in the UK and buy a region-free Blu-ray player, over $200 in total just to watch one film. Why, you might be asking. Is it really that good? After viewing it, I can answer with a definitive yes. Now, I am not an entirely insane person. I did not sit down for nearly 6 hours straight and watch this film. I may be able to sit through a 6-hour baseball game, Game 2 of the 2014 NLDS between my beloved San Francisco Giants and the Washington Nationals, but I will be the first to admit that even 2 hours is long for a silent film. I watched this over a period of about 4 days, one act a day. What are my thoughts? We'll get to that in a moment. First, I'd like to briefly discuss the history of the film. This is the story of Napoleon. Well, I'm certainly not going to discuss the man himself. There is plenty of literature to read on the Emperor, including The Campaigns of Napoleon by David G. Chandler and With Eagles to Glory, Napoleon and His German Allies in the 1809 Campaign by John H. Gill. No, I want to focus on Abel Gance, the director of Napoleon. Gance was born in Paris in 1889. As the illegitimate son of Dr. Abel Flamont and working-class mother François Perrothon. He spent his early childhood with his maternal grandparents in the coal mining town of Commentary in central France. At the age of 8, he returned to Paris to be with his mother and her new husband, Adolphe Gance, whose last name he took up. Gance left school at the age of 14 and eventually found himself in the theater. At 18, he joined the Théâtre Royal du Parc in Brussels. Gance, who at first thought of cinema as infantile and stupid, was drawn into the industry due to poverty. Gance would direct films such as La Digue, La Folie du Docteur Toube, and Mater Dolorosa. The latter was a commercial success. During the Great War, Gance directed Jacques Hughes, using real footage from battles that he had shot during his brief stint. The film, which confronts the waste and suffering the war had wrought, brought him international acclaim. His next film, La Rue, would influence countless contemporary directors, utilizing a rapid cutting technique in the editing room. The original film ran for nearly 9 hours, over 32 reels of film, but it was eventually edited down to 150 minutes. The 2019 restoration runs nearly 7 hours in total. Which brings us to the film of the hour, Napoleon. Gantz originally wanted to make 6 films from Bonaparte's early life to his death. However, he spent all of the money raised on the first film. The film utilizes a multitude of experimental techniques from rapid cutting, handheld cameras, superimposition of images, and the famous triptych sequence. The triptych sequence comprised of shooting an entire scene with 3 cameras side by side by side. This ended up hurting the distribution of the film, as theaters would have been required to utilize 2 additional projectors to display the sequence. Many theaters did not want to pay for the cost, only showing the center panel at most screenings. Now that we know a little bit about Gantz and the film, let's dive into the actual film itself. Over 5 hours and 32 minutes, we see Napoleon as a young boy through the invasion of Italy in the year 1797. Now, I was quite shocked at how Gantz portrays Napoleon. Napoleon wanted to create a new Roman Empire for himself. Yet in this film, he's treated as a hero. The same man who would later be run out of France and exiled twice. But then it dawned on me. Perhaps the portrayal of Napoleon would have changed in the subsequent films. Perhaps Gantz was portraying Napoleon as a hero because during the time period that the film takes place, he was just that. He led the revolutionary forces and was vital to France after the Reign of Terror. A Newsweek article by Brian Eads from 2014, link in the transcript, provided some light. The French largely cannot decide if Napoleon was a hero or a tyrant. Left-leaning thinkers think of him as the latter, whereas more conservative thinkers regard him as a hero. Was Gantz conservative? Or has perception changed in the last nearly 100 years? Gantz was an idealist, and given the landscape of Europe in the 1920s, that idealism could be what pushed him to show Napoleon in such a light. Perhaps he wanted to make his fellow countrymen and women feel proud about their history, proud to be French, proud about how they dismantled their monarchy. Yet it is still very possible that had Gantz made the other 5 films, the saga would have been less idealistic and more a deconstruction of a man who, like Icarus, flew too close to the sun. It must be stated, however, that idealism is present throughout the film, none more so evident than in one particular scene where La Marseillaise, the French national anthem, is taught to a crowd of revolutionaries. As a silhouetted Bonaparte broods in the corner, the fervent crowd passionately learns this new anthem that becomes their battle cry in dismantling King Louis and his court. Carl Davis, the composer of the Kevin Brownlow edit, does a great job of incorporating the song into his score, and it's hard not to hum along to it. It's a scene that inspires people to think, this is our country. It must work for us, not for those in power. Yet, perhaps Gantz was not trying to glorify Napoleon at all, idealistic as the film may be. Perhaps he sought to understand what turned Napoleon into the dictator he would become. The film is quick to remind us, time and time again, how Napoleon was often picked on by his superiors, despite his clear military prowess. He was picked on as a child due to his short stature and his accent. He is imprisoned after his victory at Toulon, simply out of jealousy. A person can only take getting kicked down time and time again before things turn ugly. He is given power out of desperation, and due to that desperation, he proclaims, quote, "Once my sword leaves its scabbard, it will not return until order has been restored." Therein lies the issue. What is Bonaparte's definition of order? He did not declare himself emperor at this moment, but this is what led him to that path. The French once again put their trust in the wrong man, for only he can claim order is restored when he thinks order is restored, or rather, when he says order is restored. He then says, in front of hundreds of French subjects, that he is now the revolution. As the old saying goes, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And perhaps this is a cautionary tale, as much as it is a celebration of his triumphs. Our story continues in a moment. And now, back to the story. There is one character in particular I'd like to discuss, and no, it's not Napoleon. This character is less of a character and more so a symbol. The symbol of the eagle. Now, the eagle was the chief symbol of Napoleon's reign, as it became known as the Imperial Eagle. Gantz takes an interesting approach to this, since the film does not venture into Napoleon's time as Emperor of France. He depicts Napoleon having a pet eagle as a boy in school. His kinship with the bird leads to a sequence of superimposition where the eagle and Napoleon are seemingly one. Superimposition is the act of placing one image on top of another, giving a sort of bleeding effect. When two schoolboys decide it would be fun to release the bird, young Napoleon is furious, causing a massive pillow fight. It is from here on that Gantz portrays the protagonist as having the spirit of the eagle. Now, what does the eagle symbolize? Throughout history, the eagle has been used time and time again. According to the New Acropolis, the Greeks and Persians dedicated it to the sun as a symbol of the spirit. The eagle was the emblem of Zeus. The Druids regarded the bird as the symbol of the Almighty. The eagle is famous for its fearless flight and its swiftness, giving way to attributes of power and nobility. In the Bible, the eagle is associated with St. John the Evangelist because of his direct perception of the inspiring light. The eagle resembled Roman power and the celestial spirit in the Aztec tradition. It's also used as the symbol of freedom in American culture. All of that feeds into Napoleon, his ego, and his lust for power. Before battle, Gantz incorporates rapid cutting between Napoleon and the eagle to express Napoleon's fighting spirit coming to the forefront. His resolve and passion eclipses any negative thoughts. It happens when he convinces the people of Corsica that their allegiance should lie with France. It happens again when he commands his troops to soldier on in the Battle of Toulon. It is, albeit, a little disorienting, but the point is made clear. Napoleon is fearless and swift, just like the eagle. The end of the film sees Napoleon using his eagle eyes to look up in the sky and see into the future, foreshadowing his coming conquest of Europe, fearlessness and swiftness. It should also be noted that the eagle appears perched above Napoleon as he rests following the Battle of Toulon. It appears again at the very end to usher Napoleon's army into Italy. Divine intervention, perhaps? I don't know. If that was truly Gantz's message, it just reasserts his tireless effort to meticulously craft this grand epic. Let's shift focus to the cinematography of this film. Gantz incorporates techniques not normally seen in film at this time, but have since become staples in filmmaking. In battles, he often goes for a handheld approach. This gives the battles a visceral, real feeling. Many directors today opt to go for the handheld look because it makes the audience feel as if they are there, in the middle of the action. Gantz takes it even a step further. He'll use the technique in lavish dance scenes and in one tremendous snowball fight. Gantz is bringing history alive. It makes the film feel alive. At the time, the camera did not move much, especially in American cinema. Directors would set up a camera and let an entire scene play out. Gantz turns all of that on its head. This film takes both cinematography and editing seriously. The camera is involved in the storytelling, rather than witnessing the story. Gantz also uses close-ups as much as we do today, always regarded as the shot that turns actors into stars. Actor Albert Dieudonné knows how to milk every close-up he gets as well. He has the perfect face for Napoleon. Stern, stoic, always planning his next conquest. Probably the most interesting thing Gantz does with the camera is in the scene where the French subjects are learning the new French anthem. He places the camera on a swing of sorts and rocks the camera back and forth the entire length of the set. This embodies the roller coaster of emotions French citizens must have felt at the time of such political and social upheaval. And now we've come to the part of the episode where I give my honest opinion about the film. I had never seen Napoleon before buying the film. I had only heard of it and seen some stills. Without a doubt, it holds up to its reputation. This is not a bucket list movie to haphazardly cross off your list. It demands your attention and has a much brisker pace than most of its contemporaries. The action sequences are probably the best ever produced at this point in film history, and there are some genuinely humorous moments. I found myself cracking up at the scene where Napoleon employs a famous actor to teach him how to be romantic so that he may woo his beloved Josephine. The scene that will stay in my mind for a long time is the scene in which Bonaparte speaks to the ghosts of the revolution in the empty Congress. It is here he declares his plans for dominating all of Europe so that, as he puts it, everyone can claim the same fatherland. Both the technique of superimposition to give the ghosts their translucent appearance and Dieudonné's performance mix perfectly to create a powerhouse in filmmaking achievement. Carl Davis's score is breathtaking. It is what truly ties the film together, and I believe no other score would do the film as great a justice. In an interview he gave for the Blu-ray extras, Davis stated how there was no way he could write 5 straight hours of new music, so he looked to who was alive in the late 18th century. Of course, all the greats were around. Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn. Davis had his pick. Davis made the informed decision of choosing material by Beethoven to bridge gaps in his own score. Beethoven and Napoleon had crossed paths. In fact, Beethoven had named his 3rd symphony in honor of Napoleon. However, once he found out that Bonaparte had declared himself emperor, Beethoven angrily retracted the dedication, thinking the newly crowned dictator had lost all his morals. Davis also employs the use of Corsican folk songs, French revolutionary songs, and selects from Bonaparte's favorite opera, Nina, by Giovanni Paisiello. The main theme Davis creates for Napoleon is a wonderful piece of music that matches the grandeur of the film it inhabits. Now, I cannot finish this episode without discussing the triptych. It is truly awe-inspiring to watch. Gantz wanted the audience to know the scope of these battles. And I don't think a film shot in today's standard 1.85:1 or 2.39:1 would have done it as much justice as the triptych does. It's like watching an undistorted panoramic shot. That's how wide the shot is. I can only imagine how incredible it would be to experience this on the biggest screen possible. Nothing like it has been seen before or since. Shame on the theater exhibitors who refused to show all 3 panels. Only watching the center panel robs the sequence of its tremendous storytelling powers. It is a film I cannot recommend enough. I hope it becomes more readily available in the United States in the coming years, and I hope you take the chance to watch it. It is unlike anything you have ever seen. Next week, we will continue our exploration of French history through film with Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. Thank you for stopping by on this week's episode of Film Survey. This show is researched, written, and hosted by myself, J.G. Murphy, and is part of the TMK Pictures family of podcasts. If you would like to view a transcript of this episode, it will be available on filmsurveypodcast.com. If you would like to share your thoughts with me on this film, make sure to follow @filmsurveypodcast on Instagram, or you can shoot me a message on Twitter @thejgmurphy. You can also email me directly at jgmurphy@tmkpictures.com. It is possible I may share your thoughts with the rest of the community. I host another podcast, Obscurities of the Silver Screen, with my dear friend and colleague Remy Gray. Episodes are available on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Please be sure to check out more of TMK's content, including Space Stuff, Look Ma No Helmet, and Inner Idiot Child. All shows are free to watch on TMK's YouTube channel. Just look for The Green Clover. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to next week's discussion.